heretical lines that he have. It's from the film called Manufacturing Consent, done by some late great French-speaking Montrealer anarchist associated with the Black Rose bookstore up in Montreal. I wonder if it's still around. Things change. I usually like to start out with Bruce Dixon or Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report. They haven't been doing their commentaries. Maybe they're looking for a new vehicle, since it looks like there's going to be a shakeup at SoundCloud, which they just moved to, as far as using it as their audio interface on the net. Margaret Kimberling doesn't read her pieces. I've been every now and then dropping a line about her needing to read some of her essays. They are also quite provocative, I guess is the word I like to use. So, in lieu of that, I've been playing Mamouya Awa Jamal's prison commentaries from his website, Prison Radio. And I've been talking a little bit about a case, and I thought it was in a court at the state level in Pennsylvania, but it's actually a Supreme Court ruling that's having effect on his case. His prosecutor, the prosecutor in charge of his case at some level, was elevated to a judgeship and then denied his appeal. So there is a ruling at the U.S. Supreme Court case. This will be explained better by a woman lawyer in this segment following the other regular feature I use, which is Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay. Beyond that, I've got another election theft report from Greg Palast. I haven't even listened to it. He was in Chicago and was trying to stream his meeting with both Bernie Sanders and Jesse Jackson up there, trying to light a fire underneath some of the Democrats who need to talk about election theft. Maybe let's put a little energy of that instead of on Russiagate theories. If it hadn't been close, election theft wouldn't have been effective, but it was pretty close. So there's a lot of factors to weigh in the last election cycle, not elucidated by Chris Kobach, who is now second to Pence in this election integrity. Just like Harry Shearer says, laughs every time he says President Trump. I'll say that when I say election integrity commission. So, probably something generally on that. I haven't actually listened to that one either. I did listen to Mark Weisbrot talking about Puerto Rico. If I don't get time to play all of that, it's probably more suited for the show I do on Sunday afternoon, which is more international issues. But then, is Puerto Rico an international issue or not? I mean, they're a colony, right? We still have a colony. The U.S. is a colonial power in fact as well as in truth, as it were, the metaphorical colonialist. All right, here's Amy, and I think it's a follow-on to her interview with an actor. She did a part two web exclusive, so if you want to hear some more from this gentleman. I am a little out of the loop on cultural things like that. Prefer to devote my time to live jazz and don't Netflix or stream video. So I don't know who James Cromwell is, actually.
For James Cromwell, the fight against fossil fuels is no act. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Actor James Cromwell was nominated for an Academy Award for his role in the hit movie Babe, and throughout his career for numerous Emmys. But on a cold December day in 2015, the drama he participated in was no act. Cromwell and five others were arrested in upstate Wayweyunda, New York, protesting against the construction of a 650-megawatt frac gas power plant. He and two others refused to pay their fines and were sentenced to a week behind bars. On Friday, July 14th, the 77-year-old actor, along with Pramila Malik and Madeline Shaw, a grandmother, surrendered themselves to the Orange County Jail. James Cromwell is no stranger to protest. He was inspired by Southern civil rights activists, joined the anti-Vietnam War movement. He provided direct support for Black Panther activists targeted by the FBI's illegal COINTELPRO program in the 1960s. A vegan, he's been arrested protesting the treatment of animals. This latest action and subsequent jailings, however, mark an escalation in his commitment to bring about revolutionary change.
We are, all of us, engaged in a struggle not to protect the way of life, but to protect life itself.
That's James Cromwell on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, a day before he went to jail.
Our institutions are bankrupt, our leaders are complicit, and the public is basically disillusioned and disenchanted with the entire process.
The Wayweyunda gas-fueled power plant is owned by Competitive Power Ventures, CPV, which touts itself as a leader in clean energy. CPV is in turn owned by the multinational Global Infrastructure Partners, which has fossil fuel projects around the globe. The Wayweyunda plant is not complete yet, and Cromwell and others want to make sure it never is.
We changed ourselves together with bicycle locks, and we blocked the entrance to the plant for about, as according to the prosecution, about 27 minutes. And the judge and the prosecution seem to imply that it made absolutely no difference to what happened with this plant, but it does make a difference. What we're trying to get out is the message that this is one instance, but it is happening in all around this country and all around the world.
The image of James Cromwell's arrest is chilling. He's surrounded by New York State troopers, one of whom is applying a massive bolt cutter to the lock around Cromwell's neck.
There is a direct connection between that plant and the Middle East. We're at war not only with Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan and Yemen. We're at war with Dimock, Pennsylvania, where the gas comes from, with Wayweyunda that uses the gas, with Seneca Lake, where it was to be stored, and with Standing Rock.
James Cromwell explained why he risked arrest that day.
Most people can't put their finger on the cause of it, but everybody perceives the threat. Capitalism is a cancer, and the only way to defeat this cancer is to completely, radically transform our way of living and our way of thinking about ourselves. And I call that radical transformation revolutionary. So this is the revolution.
If the revolution Cromwell describes comes, it'll erupt in part from the work of the countless local grassroots groups that are springing up around the globe to address the growing catastrophe of climate change. Protect Orange County, founded by Pramila Malik, is one of those groups and is the organizing hub against the CPV plant. Malik joined Cromwell in our studio and described their strategy.
We actually can stop this. There's one permit left. The company put the cart before the horse. They don't have the permit for the lateral pipeline. And we are calling on everybody to demand of our governor, Governor Cuomo, to be a real climate leader and reject the permit for that last pipeline, the lateral pipeline, and to pull the plug on this plant.
Malik, Cromwell, and their sister protester were released from jail on Monday after 3 days of their 7-day sentence.
Going to jail is a statement about how we have to lift our game. It's no more good enough just to picket and to petition because nobody is listening. The way people get the message out is you do an act of civil disobedience.
Cromwell told us.
We have to change our relationship both to the planet and to the people who live on this planet, including the people who are opposing us.
James Cromwell has a commanding presence on the big screen and will certainly continue practicing his craft. But the primary stage for this towering actor will be the streets in what will likely be his life's most demanding role. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well, there you go. Well, I'm trying to say something about the latest Trump developments, but, well, the only thing that I think he's done relatively using that guardedly, is this cutting off the CIA program to jihadists. It's been a long policy of the U.S. to oppose any regime it wants to, secular, nationalist, any kind. It's a long history. There's a book-length study of that, Devil's Game, how it started out in sort of under Roosevelt, but there were glimmers of it in the Anglo-U.S. Policy before that. He's being derided. The Washington Post had a sort of a frank editorial saying he's defunding our proxies or something like that. They actually called him proxies, so it admitted that we were at war with Syria by proxy, and we were conducting regime change. I'm not hopeful that power-hungry people like Yeltsin and Trump will actually be thinking of anything about what the people on the ground are really needing, but I think it is a start to do that, at least. Let's try to work away from that policy. And struck by someone pointing out that even the dying Senator McCain shows his independence by retweeting that editorial from the Washington Post. It's not a surprise at all. He's as belligerent and perhaps more than most. Wanted to take on Russia when he was running about the Abkhazia and the East Ossetia territorial change in Georgia, defending the diktat of another strong man, Joseph Stalin, gave those properties to Georgia. They don't have no ethnic tie to Georgia. Abkhazia speaks a variant of Farsi, so has no cultural ties to Georgia. It needs to be examined. All right, back timing will do kind of okay unless I start talking a lot again. It's gentle rain. It's very nice. I expected it to be another scorcher right away, which it's not. It will be later, probably. Some outside, some inside events. I wish them well. I didn't shoot any outside events, even the Research Park gig. Someone posted that they're a concert in hell, and I think that... That's the way I looked for it. I looked for climatization. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the case. Here interviewed, not getting any press anywhere, but a lawyer talking somewhat about the implications of this lawsuit. In fact, I was going to cut off the last part of it because she gets into sort of the details of the discovery and how they're having non-cooperation by the current district attorney's office. Maybe they have to wait until the new guy gets elected and takes it over. A radical lawyer is scheduled to be the DA in Philly after many years of many corrupt quasi so-called Democratic leaders. Okay.
Dean, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. As we reported last week, there appears to be new information, and the battle continues to free Mumia Abu-Jamal, the longest-serving political prisoner in the United States. He is globally known for his work as a journalist, as a commentarian, and as somebody who has been suppressed in the United States of America that calls itself the Free State. Joining us to talk about the situation is Rachel Walkenstein. She is an attorney from Mumia Abu-Jamal, and I believe you're in Philadelphia now. Is that correct?
Today, I'm actually in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. Let's talk about, set this up. We are hearing that there's a new battle for information. Some new information has come forward. Set the scene for us. By the way, just remind people briefly who Mumia Abu-Jamal is, just in case they haven't heard.
Sure. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a political prisoner, a class war prisoner, I consider him. He's a former Black Panther Party member. He's a MOVE supporter, a radical journalist who was known as the voice of the voiceless. He was an award-winning radio journalist in Philadelphia in the late 70s and until his arrest on December 9th, 1981, for the murder of a police officer in Philadelphia. This is a crime that Mumia did not commit. He's always made clear that he is innocent, and we have written about his case many times as being racially biased and politically motivated. He was framed up by the Philadelphia police and the prosecution with help from actually the Attorney General's office and the FBI because of his political views and because he was so outspoken in defense of all the oppressed, and particularly for political people. In that case, at that time in Philadelphia, was the MOVE organization. But as a teenager, just less than a decade before that, he was the communications director and journalist for the Black Panther Party member when he was Black Panther Party when he was just 16 years old.
And he also reported for public radio at that time.
Yes, he did. Later on, in the late 70s, he was an NPR reporter. He also worked for a number of other radio stations. He got a Peabody Award for covering the Pope's trip to Philadelphia in the late 70s. He interviewed many people, everybody from basketball, hero Julius Erving to Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee and Bob Marley, and he was known really throughout Philadelphia for his beautiful, beautiful voice and his social and political commentary.
And he was also known throughout Philadelphia by the corrupt, perhaps the most corrupt police department, at least at that time in the country, a police department that was storied in its corruption, that was written up. There were federal investigations into the corruption of the police department, I understand, and its relationship to crooked prosecutors. That's where this sort of comes out of, isn't it?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Frank Rizzo was the commissioner of police, and who a lot of the COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program that Hoover set up, was actually based on a lot of things that Rizzo did. And then he became the mayor of Philadelphia, and he was, set up the raids on the Black Panther Party when Mumia was a member and a spokesman for it. And your point is absolutely correct, that the attacks on Mumia, the attempt to see him incarcerated and actually exterminated, was done by the FBI. One of the early things that I worked on with my colleagues in the Partisan Defense Committee at that time was obtaining Mumia's COINTELPRO records, which showed that at the age of 15, they had a dossier on him. And they said, I'm not quoting this exactly, but in effect they said, despite his young years, he was 15 then, we believe he should be on the ADEX file, which was the administrative index that they used to make the list of who should be rounded up and put into concentration camps if there was any political turmoil in the country. They said that Mumia belonged on that because of his ability to speak out and his speaking out in advocacy. So this was literally being put into, concentration camps for his political views at the time of the height of COINTELPRO in the late 60s. So this is Mumia's history, and as I indicated briefly, it was only a short decade from the time that Mumia was known, being totally outspoken in defense of the Panthers after particularly when Clark was killed in Chicago. Mumia went there, saw the murder that had been done by the FBI and the Chicago police, and came and spoke. Again, he was 16 years old and spoke out against the fact that they had been executed. And he was quoted on the front page of the mainstream newspaper there, the Philadelphia Inquirer, establishment newspaper, front page article talking about this young man who spoke in defense of the Panthers. And the cops in Philadelphia knew perfectly well who he was and tracked him. This became a much more, I wouldn't say mainstream, but a spokesman on major black radio as well as NPR throughout the city, and speaking out against police brutality, against the harassment and brutality against the MOVE organization. And then also when MOVE was attacked in 78 after a month-long surrounding of their neighborhood, and they were attacked and a police officer was shot by police fire, not by the MOVE members. There was a man named Delbert Africa, who was another former Panther, who was beaten on the street. And this was the first televised beating of somebody, just a vicious beating of him on the street in the aftermath of this attack on the MOVE commune then. And Mumia wrote in defense of the MOVE members and against the police attack. And he also was targeted specifically by Rizzo and by Edward Rendell, who your people listening to the show may know more recently as a talking head, the supposedly liberal Democrat out of Pennsylvania, out of Philadelphia. But he is responsible for, I think, very directly for the frame-up of Mumia Abu-Jamal, which is a story unto itself. But he and Rizzo targeted Mumia, and now we're talking back in 78, and saying that you are responsible for the violence in the city. I'm going to hold you and other journalists responsible for this. You are to blame, pointing him out. This is just a continuation of the targeting of him by the FBI. And so this is all, you know, done under the joint thing of the Republicans and the Democrats, Rizzo in line with Rendell, who was there as a Democratic Party representative early on and then went on to become the mayor of Philadelphia, then became the governor of Pennsylvania. He was the head of the Democratic National Committee. He was on the short list to be Hillary Clinton's VP back when she ran the first time back in 2004 for president. So there's a long history there of knowing who Mumia is and targeting him and trying to silence his voice and murder him. And basically what happened that night on December 9th, 1981, is that he came across a police altercation in the street. He was driving a cab at that point because he had been really pretty much drummed out of a lot of his more mainstream news reporting because of his defense of the MOVE organization and showing solidarity to them. And he was driving a cab for some extra money to support his family. And I believe from my work, and just to say this, is I've worked with Mumia as a lawyer, as well as a friend, as a sister, for almost for 30 years. It's been 30 years since this summer I first met him in August of 87 and began communicating with him the February before then. And I did all the investigation of the major investigation in his post-conviction hearings in Philadelphia from 1995 through 1999, where we brought out an enormous amount of concrete evidence of the prosecutorial and police misconduct and the frame-up of Mumia for this crime he did not commit. Any event, on that day, they once Mumia was there in the midst of what was intended to be a shootout in which this police officer, Daniel Faulkner, was shot and killed. The police that arrived on the scene, the chief inspector, a guy by the name of Giordano, who was also Rizzo's right-hand man a few years earlier, who was also under investigation for police corruption and in terms of also in every sort of type of on the take. He arrived on the scene along with other people. He knew who Mumia was, and he began the conscious frame-up of Mumia at that point, knowing, you know, who they found on the street that night. And at that point, they invented, supposedly Mumia confessed that night. They said that Mumia's gun was found on the scene, and it was the murder weapon. And he also brought forward a witness two witnesses. One is a prostitute who was actually working, doing tricks for the cops to keep herself going and to be an informant herself so she could do her work on the street. And also a cab driver who was, we learned later, was coerced into testifying against Mumia.
Let's fast forward now. There was a major setup. Obviously, this was somebody who was way ahead of his time taking on police violence, the heart of the matter. He was Black Lives Matter before anybody had a national sense of what this kind of systematic violence was. So take us, you had a meeting with the judge. There's apparently new information, new evidence. What is it?
What happened is about a year ago, there was a very important case that was decided by the United States Supreme Court. And what it involved is the fact that one of the chief justices, and was the chief justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, that's the state court, had been the prosecutor in Philadelphia. He followed Rendell as the DA, the chief DA. And even though he had been the DA and ran on a platform in support of the death penalty, supporting DAs who committed prosecutorial misconduct, also that he was supported by the Fraternal Order of Police, he was not only endorsed by them, he got major funding for them, and he ran as a law and order DA. Nonetheless, when he became elected on that same platform to be the Supreme Court Justice, he sat and ruled on a number of cases, including Mumia's case, as a DA, and despite requests for him to remove himself on the grounds of bias and conflict of interest. So the U.S. Supreme Court about a year ago, in a different case, the name of Terry Williams, found finally, after many attempts to get a ruling on this, that it is a conflict of interest and the denial of a fair, impartial appeal process for somebody who is a judge who had previously been personally involved in some significant fashion in a prosecution as a prosecutor to sit as a judge, and that it required basically all the appeals that judge had sat on and there had been negatively decided against the defendant to be thrown out and be able to start over again. So based on this ruling, Mumia's lawyers, I'm not counsel of record in this matter, brought an action last August to challenge Mumia's appeals because Castile was the district attorney who was in charge of all the appeal issues on Mumia's case at the time that dealt with his Black Panther Party membership, dealt with the jury selection, keeping blacks off the jury, and also the prosecution basically trying to get the jury to convict and sentence people to death with thinking that their vote didn't matter and that the person would have appeal after appeal. All key significant issues in Mumia's appeal, Castile was the person who had to articulate and distinguish why Mumia's case should be upheld as new Supreme Court decisions have been decided on each of these issues. A Supreme Court that Castile was not a part of at that time ruled against Mumia. Then Castile became a Supreme Court justice himself, having already been the architect of all the DA's support of Mumia's conviction. And during the period of time that I was describing earlier that I was involved in the case and all the challenges to Mumia's conviction that began again in 1995 through really 2008, many, many challenges on those same grounds and many others dealing with frame-up witnesses who were coerced, forced to lie, new evidence of his innocence, a confession from somebody else that he shot Faulkner, the police officer. Castile refused to remove himself from the case and instead ruled against Mumia in these cases. So the argument is being made that Castile violated this fundamental precept, which should be that, you know, he was a prosecutor involved in Mumia's case and he should not have been a judge. He should have removed himself. So what's happened now is that these things don't happen automatically. Mumia's case in court finally got some arguments. The DA's office tried to get it thrown out on grounds that it was brought too late. It didn't apply. The judge said, yes, it does apply. It has to go forward. Then became the issue of the DA's office being compelled and ordered, as they were, to come forward with evidence that shows Castile's involvement. And what they have done in the past 2 weeks is they have been non-compliant with the judge, and they have been recalcitrant in not providing real information. So the first filing that they had that they gave in response to the judge order was to simply dump 40 pages that are simply from the public record, really the first page of each of the filings that they did that has Castile's name on it, but no information, no records, no drafts of the appeals, no conferences, no nothing of his involvement in it. This is despite the fact that Castile has filed statements in terms of his Supreme Court run that says that he took personal involvement in these appeals, particularly appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court, which Mumia's case did go to the U.S. Supreme Court. So Mumia filed another motion for the DA's office to comply and to search the records again and explain where they searched and where they looked and all that. And they came up with one paragraph saying, well, we did look in 31 boxes and we had two people look in and look for this and look for that. But it doesn't deal with the fact of whether they went through Castile's files. There's no mention that they went through Castile's files, is the DA, and his chief assistant's files, who worked very closely with Castile. And also one of the chief people working on Mumia's appeals has been working on it since 1986 and sat there in the courtroom during all these hearings in the 90s, was a man who was personally appointed by Castile to be his in charge of the appeals division. And he's actually arguing the case on behalf of the DA's office now. He's still around 30 years later, still working on the case. And there's nothing from him that indicates what role he took or any statement at all that says whether or not he had or confirming what he had to have had was consultations with Castile over this.
A longtime activist, and I should have written her name down. I thought I could remember it, but it went right by. It's on Flashpoints, recent episode this week. Available on SoundCloud, as long as SoundCloud's going to be around. I don't know. They've had a big retrenchment. I actually don't use it very much. Well, anyway, so hopefully the new DA that got elected in the Philly area will be cooperative as opposed to the stonewalling that's going on. I'm sure there are a lot of people worried about pulling that stuff apart from that era, since there was such rampant corruption in all the cases that this guy acted on appeal against when he was later a judge, should be reviewed along with Mumia Abu-Jamal's. Two more sections from Flashpoints. The friend of this ground, Mark Weisbrot, activist in, I remember visiting the Preamble Center. Preamble of the Constitution includes promote the general welfare, if you remember. Had a different meaning then, but, well, anyway. And now with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, also with Just Foreign Policy, ran for, in the primary, I believe, he was primaried out for the position that hopefully, and this is my opinion, not WEF's opinion, the current Rodney Davis occupies. But we'll get to a section of that, and I'll try to play all of it tomorrow. It's about Puerto Rico. Includes nuggets about his analysis that you never hear about general economics away from the what's the word for that? Canon of the ideas. That's not right, but anyway, here's Greg Pallas with the Election Protection Report. We should be segueing into that, and I haven't heard this yet, but sure, Kurt Kobach will come up.
so many other things. Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
30
go
seconds.
Go buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would say. I'm going to go get some on myself today.
I don't even think it was controversial. You know, I proved them. I haven't even heard. I haven't had one call from anybody saying, oh, that was a terrible thing you did.
Shut up!
And welcome to the Election Crimes Bulletin. Things are breaking quickly. We welcome back Greg Palast, the best democracy money can buy. Well, Greg, today is the first official day of the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity with your old friend Chris Kobach. What is this thing and what's happening today?
Today, Chris Kobach, who I've been investigating for Rolling Stone, Al Jazeera, and for Flashpoints for the past 4 years, launched his commission to prove Donald Trump's claim that millions of people are voting illegally, and specifically are voting democratically for the 3 million people voted twice, that 1 million Mexicans swam the Rio Grande to vote for Hillary, and so this is the commission to prove those claims. Many people are unfortunately taking this as a joke, you know, like, oh, this is fraudulent. I mean, there's no such thing as these double voters, these millions of illegal voters. Well, okay, wipe that smile off your face right now. This is not a joke, because they're using this claim of fraudulent voters to suppress the vote, to take away the votes of legal voters. This is serious stuff. Everything from claiming that people with names like Jose Garcia or James Brown have voted twice because they found millions of people with names like James Brown and Jose Garcia, which I admit are unusual names for Republicans. They've also claimed that 1 million people, literally aliens, voted in our election, and Kobach said for Hillary, so I want to make that clear. It's not just random. Again, they're using this to create the basis for brand new legislation to take away the voting rights we have now for voters of color. This is serious business, and the media is playing it like it's comedy. It ain't no joke, Dennis. And I want to add that I had a meeting this Sunday with Senator Bernie Sanders and with Jesse Jackson on a program to systematically combat this attack on voter rights. This is Jesse Jackson and Sanders are announcing an alliance to go after this game and bust it.
All right, now remind us who Chris Kobach is, because this guy is clearly a white supremacist. He's also running for governor, I believe, of Kansas now.
Yes.
He's the current Secretary of State, but he's not messing around. He has a history of supporting racist legislation. We saw it in Arizona. Remind people who he is.
Yes, and I don't call people white supremacists, you know, at the drop of a hat. He literally is the attorney for a group called FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which says its purpose is to maintain a European United States, and we know that you don't need a translator to know what European means, but it ain't voters of the darker persuasion. So he is a white supremacist. He also wrote SB 1070, which the ACLU calls the driving while brown law for Arizona, citizenship proof for voting laws in Kansas, Alabama, Georgia. He is the new face of the new Jim Crow. So, but importantly, he's not just a freak on the fringe. He's the guy that was appointed by Donald Trump to run his so-called, what Trump himself calls the Voter Fraud Commission, hunting for these fraudulent voters, technically the President's Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, which, by the way, is like putting Al Capone in charge of investigating the mob. This guy is the Purgeon General of the United States. He's the guy that, if you've heard on prior Flashpoints, created this program called CrossCheck, supposedly identifying 3 million Americans who he claims may potentially have voted twice, and he's removing them systematically from the voter rolls without proof that they voted twice. Because after all, if you vote twice, it's a crime. You ought to go to, frankly, you ought to go to jail. But he's not prosecuting people. He's prosecuted like 8 cases, but literally 1.1 million voters have lost their vote based on Kris Kobach's accusations. This is serious stuff, Dennis.
This is a national intimidation campaign against black and brown voters, Asian voters, voters who anybody thinks, who these folks think might vote Democratic, essentially, is in the target, in the crosshairs. They've, as you say, had a real impact in the past, but today they sort of were starting in earnest. Today is the first day of the rest of their lives. He was sworn in, if that means anything. And you have now had meetings with Jesse Jackson and Bernie Sanders. Why do they care? How have they engaged in this? What's their involvement now?
Well, Bernie Sanders flew into Chicago to meet with the Reverend Jesse Jackson. I was asked to join the meeting. In fact, I filmed some of it. You can see that at gregpalace.com. They're really concerned that the public is not taking this seriously enough. As Sanders says, and you'll get this in the film, this is a signal. When Trump says that there are millions of illegal voters, this is a signal, he says, to governors, go suppress the vote. Now, the systems are created by this character, Kris Kobach, Secretary of State of Kansas, who is running for governor, so he may soon be Governor Kobach, including such things as cross-check, where they have literally 7.2 million names. These are common names, you know, which means Rodriguez and James Brown, et cetera, people that they've accused of voting twice because they have a name like James Brown. And it would be hysterically funny, almost slapstick, except that literally, when I worked for Rolling Stone, we calculated with our expert about 1.1 million people lost their right to vote. And so the laughter has to stop. And then, you know, that aliens are voting, et cetera. So today is the first day of their official commission to make it look like some type of multi-ethnic rainbow. They've included Ken Blackwell as a commissioner on Trump's commission. Ken Blackwell, you may remember, he's African-American. He was the Republican Secretary of State of Ohio who made sure that John Kerry was not President of the United States in 2004 by removing, we actually have the documentation that he had, that he removed voting machines from black precincts so that you had lines of 7, 8, and 9 hours and they would lock people off, stopping them from voting. African-American absentee ballots were rejected because in those precincts, some ballots
Where did this happen?
Yeah, this happened in Ohio in 2004. Ken Blackwell, who basically manipulated the vote count and suppressed, we use the term suppressed, which is a polite term for stealing the votes of African-Americans in 2004. That's how George W. Bush was reelected president of the United States.
And this was confirmed in court, right?
Here's the problem. Just like when I did the story in 2000 about Catherine Harris removing black people as felon, calling them felons, not a single one was. George Bush won by 537 votes. So after these elections, and after Bush is inaugurated once, then 2004 inaugurated twice, Catherine Harris writes an apology letter. Ken Blackwell has to admit that the procedures he used that knocked out black voters were wrong, but they're laughing. They're apologizing and laughing at the same time from the inaugurations of these Republican officials. The truth is there were not enough white guys to elect Donald Trump, and they used Kobach's, Blackwell's vote suppression techniques in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina, Arizona, to flip this vote. And now they're trying to institutionalize these vote suppression techniques on a national basis. Kobach is calling for all states to join his so-called cross-check program looking for these double voters named Jose Rodriguez and Jose Garcia. You know, there's 836,000 Americans with the last name Garcia. Yeah, there's a few people named Joe in there, or Jose. And they're using that fact, the artifact of the conquest, the artifact of slavery, where people have common names, to knock out these voters of color. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're doing it under the color of saying that there's massive vote fraud, even though, by the way, Kris Kobach has the prosecutorial authority to jail double voters. He makes the accusation, like Joe McCarthy back in the Red Scare period, I have lists of double voters, I have lists of communists. It's the same thing. He does, yeah, he's got lists, but he has no people who've actually committed this crime. That he glosses over, but it's used to knock out legitimate voters. And I was thrilled to, and honored to be actually in the room with Senator Sanders and Jesse Jackson, planning on how they can counter this brand new, massive attack on voting rights.
All right, what is the modus operandi? Because one gets the impression that there's massive resistance. He's made some requests from the states for information about voters. Lay that out for us, because it seems like there's massive resistance across the country to this.
I wish there were, and fairy tales do come true, but they didn't happen to you in this case. Kris Kobach's commission in Washington, the Trump Commission on Voter Integrity, asked all 50 states to provide lists of their voters, which includes birth dates, last four digits of your Social Security number, and CNN ran a quite phony story, to be honest, that 44 states had resisted Trump's demand for this voter file information, because when the word got out, people got freaked out that the federal government, that this guy Kris Kobach was getting, you know, your personal information and voter files. And so it looked like the Republicans were resisting. In fact, the guy from Louisiana, the Secretary of State, who's Republican in Louisiana, said they've asked for this stuff before. I've never given it to them. The Republican Secretary of State of Mississippi said they can go jump in the Gulf. What they didn't say, Dennis, that they'd already given Kobach their voter files, Social Security numbers included. Not to his Washington office, that they wouldn't do because there was too much heat on them. Rather, they give it to him in his Kansas office, which he used in this system we call interstate cross-check, which is supposedly looking for double voters. So they've already turned over, in January, they turned over these voter rolls. 28 states, 98 million voter records were handed to Kris Kobach. By the way, sent to an unsecured server in Alabama that he controls. These 28 states included almost every Republican state that told CNN that they wouldn't send him the files. If you go to gregpalace.com, you can actually see the chart, which, by the way, I got from Kobach's office. This is not secret material. His lists are secret. I've got those too. But the summary chart of which states have given him voter files, 28 states, 25 of them Republican states, you can see that at gregpalace.com. That's actually a public record from Kobach's office. To CNN, they say, we would never turn over our voter files. No way. Secretly, quietly, they did.
Amazing. Now, as you mentioned, you've got Jesse Jackson in here working on this and also Bernie Sanders. And Jackson, I believe, has appointed somebody who will sort of take this on head on. Barbara Arnwine, tell us about what she will be doing and what the counteract is being planned through this meeting with Jesse Jackson and Bernie Sanders.
Well, Jesse Jackson obviously is seeing his life's work rolled back and destroyed. The work he did with Dr. King, starting with the march from Selma to Montgomery and the winning of the Voting Rights Act. So he's asked Barbara Arnwine, who everyone in the field recognizes as the number one voting rights expert attorney in the field, to head a real commission, not with these kind of soft racist freaks and wackos that Trump has appointed, but with real experts, to look into what this commission is doing and the issue of vote suppression and the use of vote fraud as a cover for vote suppression. So it's Barbara Arnwine and his commission, which is a serious commission of experts, will be co-chaired and headed with Terry O'Neill, the attorney who is now the president of the National Organization of Women, a real expert on these voting rights issues, who, by the way, also knows that these attacks seriously affect the power of women over their own destiny and their own voting rights. So we have Terry O'Neill, we have Barbara Arnwine, and several other top experts in the field that Jackson has asked to create a real commission to provide real information. Bernie Sanders has joined in. Reverend Jackson has told me that he has others ready to support the fight against Kobach and his systems, including and particularly cross-check. I mean, Sanders was stunned when he saw the evidence of what Kobach was doing. I mean, he's just actually, his eyes popped. You'll see this on the video I have at gregpalace.com. It looks like Reverend Jackson will also be having a meeting now with Senator Elizabeth Warren to go over these vote suppression tactics. She's very interested in jumping in on the fight and needs the information. There'll be and Senator Durbin looks like he's joining the fight too. So it sounds like we have at least three members of the White Congressional Caucus joining in to fight vote suppression. I think it's going to grow.
And in terms of how can people track this, why has it taken so long? I know, Greg, you and I have been talking about this for a long time. It seems like up until this point, the Democratic Party was not interested. They didn't believe it, or they didn't want to seem like they were sore losers. Is there something that's changed? Is this now more prominent because Kobach has got this commission? Is that the moving force at this point?
Unfortunately, the Democratic Party has been more dismissive of Kobach, saying that, oh, there's no voter fraud. But they won't talk about the other side of the coin. As Senator Sanders says, look, this is vote fraud claims are a clear signal to Republican governors to suppress the vote. The Democratic Party is not talking about that side of the equation, about race. And, you know, we can all speculate. It is the opinion of many of the people I spoke to this weekend who were with Reverend Jackson that the discomfort in the Democratic Party to identify with black voters, to be seen as the party of the minority voter, to be seen as the black party. In places like Georgia, where I just went to investigate vote suppression in the recent congressional runoff, the Democratic Party is loath to be identified with fighting for the rights of minority voters because they don't want to be seen as the black party. And that's, you know, so that's impeded this fight. Bernie Sanders is not afraid of standing up for voting rights for black voters and Asian voters and Hispanic voters who have been targeted. We're going to see where Elizabeth Warren comes down now that she's got that, you know, that she's got a presidential fever. But I think that Reverend Jackson is going to be putting the wood to these people and asking them, which side are you on?
You know, I've seen Bernie Sanders many times in person, and he raises this issue in a very structural way in terms of what got him involved in politics in terms of the suppression of black voters and minority votes. But it wasn't a major part of his campaign. So hopefully this signals a change in which he's going to make it front and center in his vision of trying to create a more democratic United States of America.
Well, I think in talking to Bernie and Jesse in that room is that I think that Senator Sanders understands there's no progressive action if we don't protect the voting rights of minority voters. So, you know, everything else falls if we don't have the vote. And when they take away the votes of black and Hispanic and Asian voters, progressive votes of white folk are nullified. You ain't going to get your forgiveness for student loans if you take away the voting rights of black voters. So it, you know, you can't just talk to students and progressives in, you know, in Park Slope, New York. You know, you have to reach out to the black community and the Latino community, and bless Sanders because he's done so, and let's see if he can drag in the rest of the Democratic Party. This has always been the question mark, and I can't answer the question, which is where are the Democrats? I think we'll get an answer. I'm hoping when Jackson has his meeting with Elizabeth Warren. And see whether she's ready to step out.
All right. Well, you can see the article at gregpalace.com. You also have some film up yes. of your visit to Chicago with Jesse Jackson and Bernie Sanders. People can go to gregpalace.com to see that as well. And, Greg, we know that this hasn't always been a fight that people want to jump into, but we are always glad to stay with this and to continue our election crimes bulletin, because the crime against voting now being faced by brown and black people, Asian people in this country, this is serious, and they are now focused on the next election. So we thank you again for this good information, Greg Palast.
And thanks to Flashpoints for letting the truth out when others would crush it down.
All right. Be careful. We'll talk to you soon.
You got it.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Oh, my go-to guys. And if you were waiting around to hear Mark Weisbrot, well, sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. I was thinking I wasn't going to talk so much today. It added up to an hour show when I calculated it. So I have a little time for some announcements. There's another of the Champagne... Oh, no, this is at the Champagne Public Library, but a group called the Socialist Alternative is having a meeting there at 2 to 4. Oh, gosh, that just gives me the picture. Healthcare is a human right. And a lot of class analysis in it. So that's 2 to 4 if you want to try something completely different. Actually, there's a couple of completely different things over in Urbana at the IMC, Girls Rock, local group that's trying to get young women to let their freak flag fly. Well, where is that lyric from? Some Summer of Love song, I guess. It's an open house, and that is from 12:30 to 4 at the Independent Media Center on Broadway. There's going to be some live music. You can meet the board members of Girls Rock. Certainly be some hands-on time with rock instruments. It's free and it's open to all ages. They're doing some fundraisers around town. They have something called Ladies Rock Workshop, so I know that's forthcoming. But there's a Girls Rock CU website to find out more than I can make up here as I'm going along. After that, there's belly dancing. That's what I remember. It goes on for quite a while. There used to be a belly dancing group in town that had a great name, but it was not great enough for me to remember it, but I remember I was impressed. This is sponsored by Classy Combinations, and so Girls Rock and then belly dance. Sounds like it might be healthy. All right, I didn't have to worry about back timing into that very much. I was going to play a little sample of some live local music. Support your live local music. There are some outside events. The heat alert goes off at 7. I don't know if we'll have immediate relief. There's some outside events. Alto Vineyards features Kilbourne Alley, where Painkillers were last week, and I didn't make it, and they're promising to play in the climatized Clark Bar tonight as opposed to outside on the patio. So they think the heat alert might